Good morning.
Good morning, Top Song.
Yeah.
Tell me from where you are coming and what are you doing in Auroville?
Yes. My name is Lobsang Wangtak and I come from a region called Zanskar in Ladakh. So I have to give you a little context. I will usually introduce myself as I come from a Ladakh within Ladakh, mainly because it remains a very isolated region within Ladakh that is cut off from its own district headquarters and neighboring Leh for about 6 months. So for the past, until now, the only lifeline for us used to be walking on the frozen river that is known as the Chadar Frozen River Trek now, very popular among trekkers. And things are going to change very rapidly. And I've been involved in some water conservation project, heritage preservation, and trying to adapt alternative solutions that can be implemented in the context of Zanskar. So that's why I got this opportunity to be part of this Auroville Learning Exchange Program, which has just begun. And it turns out that I'm the first person to be part of the program, although they wanted to start it 2 years ago, but because of COVID, it couldn't happen. And here I'm trying to explore all the alternative solutions people have been working on within Auroville in different pockets and see, learn from the experience, get a tangible experience and, you know, prioritize a few projects that could be collaborated with this companies and individuals in Auroville and can be implemented back home. So what can be implemented, we still have to figure out and it'll take some time, but I'm really looking forward to where it will grow and see some impact.
Okay, you said it will change soon in Zanskar. Mm. May you explain, please?
Yes, so I will, it might seem exaggerated, but I actually believe none of the Himalayan region has ever faced a circumstance like this, where Zanskar is now. It's right on the crossroad of a very major rapid change. That means it is, geographically, it is at the epicenter of three major places. One is Himachal, Manali, then you have Kargil, then you have Leh, two major cities within Ladakh. So we are right in the middle. So there's chances of us becoming just a transit point and we being exposed to the major mass package tourism coming into Ladakh, you know. It's just a matter of adding one more day or two more days to these package tours and we will be exposed to the same kind of people. So, but it hasn't been exposed yet, but we could see within a matter of 1 or 2 years, things could change drastically and we can have very disastrous impacts on not just only on the culture, demography of the place, but also the glaciers that nobody seemed to talk about, which is the life source for the people who live there in the Himalayan region, and also people who live downstream in communities where they use this water for farming and recharge of groundwater tables lower down the plains. And because we are right now at that crossroad, we also believe there's a lot of things we can learn from our neighbors and do something very different. Different in a way, it means most of these places in the higher altitude Himalayan region is getting more and more exposed to tourism. We see this concentration of wealth within one space. For example, in Ladakh, it's Leh or Kargil or some other little town. So the money is actually in the pockets of few people. While communities from farther isolated communities, they have to come to this concentrated places in this melting pot to earn little bit of money. But then who is making money are only few people who are concentrated in these little pockets, you know. So can we adopt a very distributive model of wealth, which means can this money that a tourist brings into the place can be distributed among the communities which actually deserve, actually the communities where actually people want to go and visit, and can they earn money out of it? So we were thinking about, you know, very standardized sustainable homestays all across Zanskar, so they also become pressure groups. Then hotels could be regulated. So there's a lot of work need to be done, but as a community, we understood that we need to understand the depth of this problem, and we should learn from the neighbors. So for the past 4 or 5 months, I've been visiting villages, carrying out discourses, debating, and trying to make sense of these changes, because they have seen glaciers disappear within their lifetime. They have seen streams running out of water within a matter of 5-10 years, you know. So they know all these problems are happening and they see it, but they don't know how to make sense out of all this. And when then we talk about new development, infrastructure development within this region, and the economy boosting up, but we don't realize the magnitude of this problem. So when I visited these villages, that's when I understood that once you aware them, they have the spirit to really do something different. And as a community, we would like to declare our own region as community preserved areas, community based tourism we would like to bring in, and we would like to offer to the travelers a kind of pristine landscape and experience that is unique to that place. That is what 15-20 years ago people used to come to Ladakh for, you know, that an experience of long trekking expeditions of 20 to 30 days, walking, crossing over passes, while you will only see 2 or 3 hamlets on the way, you know. That is what we offer. But then after 2010, there was this boom of mass package tourism that we never, nobody could foresee it. But now we know the effect of these, and we would like to try something different. And if we ever are going to get this opportunity to try something different and you know, dream together for a sustainable holistic development, then it is right now.
Okay, we are calling you the waterman of Zanskar.
Mm-hmm.
It will be interesting you tell us about the situation of water in Zanskar,
mm-hmm.
and also the fact now you have village without water, and what are you doing?
Yes. Well, there's some people call that, okay, all right. I've been working on water solutions for past 7 years now, since I started college. I just got this opportunity to work with an institute called Institute for the Village Studies in the U.S. So we used to bring students from the U.S. to immerse themselves with these isolated communities. At the end of it, we come together to do a community project while they immerse themselves completely as, you know, family members in these communities. And that's when I realized the problem of water, and I also realized my own village is facing water scarcity, not because we don't have a glacier, but because over a period of many years, like a decade, the snow pattern has been very erratic. The glaciers has been receding at an alarming rate. The snow lines on the peak has also been receding. So it was difficult for us to suffice our irrigation needs during the first irrigation period, that is usually at the end of April or early May. By that time, there was already an adaptation technique called artificial glaciers. The idea was to, you know, break the velocity of the water during autumn and winter, make it freeze over a larger surface area, so that it's lower than the glacier, and even if it doesn't snow much during that winter, you will be able to suffice the first irrigation need. And that is the most crucial, because if you miss out on the first irrigation water, that means you will have no cultivation. So more and more villages had been facing this since the later 90s and early 20s also. So I adapted that, and then later it was successful for the first 3 years, but then unfortunately there was a lot of debris coming, so it needed a lot of maintenance and cost, so we didn't want to carry it forward. Then I also tried the ice stupa technique, innovated by engineer Sonam Wangchuk, who is an environmentalist based in Ladakh, and he has been doing quite some fantastic job in this area. So the idea is similar, but then in this technique called the ice stupa, you make conical structures of ice, so it could be 12 to 15 stories high. So because it requires less surface area, it also takes longer for it to melt. So it not just to suffice your first irrigation need, but also to last through the summers. You know, so more I delved into these techniques, the more I realized actually these are very band-aid solutions, quick fixes, because even if we're making this ice, preserving this ice, the source of this water is coming from the glacier in the form of spring or stream. So until and unless we start talking about these glaciers, because the studies carried out 10 years ago by the year 2010, we could predict that within a matter of 30 years, by 2050 to 2060, most of the glacier-dependent villages in Zanskar will run out of their glacier sources, you know. But we are not addressing the problem here. We are, it feels to me like you have a very, you know, terrible disease inside your body, but then we are, you know, giving ourselves a massage and applying Band-Aid and feeling good about it. So I wanted to look for a solution that is easily scalable, you know, and cost-effective and sustainable. So the solar energy is abundant, and we just needed to intervene. The technology was already available, so we need to just procure solar pipes and a suitable submersible pump. So that's when we initiated this pilot project in a village called Pishu. Pishu was going through a very drastic change. In 2018 alone, they lost about 68 livestock, mainly because they didn't have enough fodder for that year to feed these cattle. And they were at the brink of extinction. People didn't want to stay back in the community because they had run out of the glaciers. They don't see any future. The government has been building a canal for 14 years but hasn't brought even a drop of water to the village. So their hope was almost...
May you explain what is a canal?
Oh, so canal is a water channel that is built. Traditionally, it was built very naturally by digging the earth. So over the period of time, it just becomes more firm. So the idea is to collect the water from the glacier melt and bring it down to the village and collect it in a village pond, which is again regulated and distributed among these families by the water lord, you could call it, or churpon, the policeman of the water. So it is very distributed in a very mechanized way. So you have water days. Only during your water days, you have to irrigate your fields and you have to suffice your irrigation needs. So it's one thing here we need to look at is the context of the Himalayan region. It's not about land, you know, like in the plains. You have land and you can depend on groundwater or you can depend on monsoon start vegetation. There it was really about how do we make the most out of the little water that's available, that's coming. So water will decide how many fields you would irrigate, how many children in the family would get married, and how will this people... You know, how will they manage this little scarce, little resource they have, you know? So if I have a family of, let's say, five or six brothers, then it'd be very difficult for us to distribute this, hereditary land or fields. Then it will become even more problematic, more disputes are bound to happen. So even for these people to become monks was one thing, you know, one of the brothers or two brothers go and become monks and participate in the rituals and be part of this monastic institution, or else a polygamous relationship, you know, where a woman can have two husbands, which is unlike we know in the West or we are used to. So that was also to really, making the most and avoiding disputes and making sure the resource we have is distributed well and avoid problems. So these are practices which are very specific to the context where I come from in the Himalayan region. So even if you go to Spiti or Ladakh, this is very prevalent. I'm not sure about Tibet, though. Yeah.
But yes, continue about Pishu.
Yes.
The water.
They had given up their hope. So in 2018, I visited. I always wanted to work there because I've been hearing for a long time. Pishu is like the prime example of water scarcity in Zanskar. So we thought it's not, doesn't look like a hard thing to do, you know. So in 2020, 2020 winter or early 2021 winter, it snowed less again. So now we had already promised them we will start working. So if we didn't bring water, if we were not successfully lift water into that village, the problem would be that they would have given hope once again. And they had put the hope on us, you know. So because of COVID, we didn't know where to get the grants from. And it was, but we knew that we cannot miss this opportunity and we cannot let them down. So we quickly, within a matter of 1 month, we had to come up with a very temporary solution, something that could be procured very easily, something that is not very expensive so that we could raise the funds and implement within a matter of 1 month. So we did a crowdfunding campaign online, which fetched us about 8 lakh rupees. That is how much dollars? Let me see.
We are in India. Huh? We are in India. We understand.
Yeah. Maybe $15,000. Yeah. So that was... with that money, we were actually not only able to lift water in Pishu, but an adjacent village of about 10 households. We were completely able to suffice their all irrigation needs. And after that, then we had the opportunity to get a little grant here and there. Now we also officially became the first Indian partner to Hanol Foundation, Alex Hanol's foundation, who invest in funds these kind of projects in communities all across the world. So they have been kind enough to give us a grant of about $25,000, which we still haven't been able to receive it. It's been almost a month, and I'm quite sure if you're living in India, you would know how these FCRA and procedures work. Foreign currency revenue. Yeah, so we still haven't been able to receive it, but the process is going on. Then the idea, after getting 25 lakh from the Hanol Foundation, we would like to completely suffice their needs. So next 15 to 20 years, they would not have to worry about anything. And then not just about lifting water, but then there's so much land available. We want to lift water in this barren land and start, biodiversity, start making carbon sinks, because these pockets are going to be exposed to more greenhouse gases, more carbon. We don't have enough vegetation to, absorb that carbon back into the, back into the vegetation, back into the land. So these areas we would like to work. You know. But all these solutions will again be quick fixes. Maybe it's a longer term that we're looking at, but until and unless we realize the glaciers as assets of these high altitude areas, we don't start addressing the problem, we would never be able to come up with regulation and policies very specific to these communities, because the ecosystem, the higher altitude, is very local to that. So globally, if there's a rise of 1 degree Celsius, you can imagine in a place like Zanskar, it's 3 times more. And on top of that, now you're exposing mindlessly into these regions and exposing 1,000 times the traffic, 1,000 times the release of carbon dioxide and black carbon, which is becoming the one of the biggest enemies of these glaciers. But we still don't know. We still haven't assessed the health of the glaciers. So if we're talking about these glaciers lasting for another 30, 40 years, that might reduce to just 5 years also, which is basic science. And science is established well. But that's why we needed to start awaring people and start talking, making sense of science, also finding the language to do that. And we are really fighting towards, getting the government and the world to start addressing this problem of glaciers so that specific policies can be implemented. And this will be, driven by communities. That's when they are empowered. They understand the depth of the problem. This is what we want. It's not about give us this anymore. This is what we want. So communities declaring things. For example, I tell, as a community, we declare the whole region of Zanskar as ecotourism model, and we'll define that. I don't think anybody could do anything about it. We are just 20,000 people in 9,000 square kilometer. That's why we're optimistic. Maybe it could be an example.
Okay, there are two things I would like you to say to us. Mm. One day you speak about the glacier, female and male.
Mm.
What is a big surprise.
Mm-hmm.
And the other things, I would like you tell us about all the how you said that, cultural things are disappearing in craft and this and
Okay. Okay, so first is male and female glaciers. It seems some areas in Ladakh and right now prominently in Gilgit-Baltistan and parts of Pakistan, research has been done very recently to study a very traditional way of making ice or developing glaciers, small sizes, and then it grows to bigger sizes. So I precisely don't know how big can it grow, but the idea was to identify male and female glaciers. So the glaciers with more albedo, that is the reflective property of a glacier, that reflects most of the UV rays back, you know, right now, because there's so much black carbon and debris on these glaciers, it's just retaining more heat because it's more material and, you know, black absorbs more. So it's also creating this habitat for these glaciers to melt even faster. So the reflective layer is called the female glacier, and then you have the ones that is darker, that is supposed to be the male glaciers. So there's a certain technique where you bring these together and like a basket full, so half of it will be filled with the female glacier, half of it filled with the male glacier, and there's a technique and a definite proportion of using charcoal or ash, you know, mix it well, and then they bring it to a higher elevation and put it underneath the ground. Underneath the ground means the permafrost ground. So when you make round structure like that and put that in the permafrost ground, then it acts as a bonding agent. So any sort of form of precipitation, whether rain or snow, will start attracting. If there's water going around, it'll start attracting. You know, it's just pulling these different forms of water and then letting it grow. So it has been actually studied. So I was also very surprised when I found this out just recently, studying about this. And these were practiced 200, 300 years ago, very prevalent in these regions. It's interesting to understand. So now in this context, when we talk about glaciers, then we also need to start talking about how can we rejuvenate or regenerate glaciers. So that's why we have just become very, very ambitious, because I come from this place. I've seen everything through my eyes, and I just am desperate that, you know, glaciers can be multiplied. So one old man, when I started talking to him, he was talking about how glaciers are disappearing. Within my lifetime, it used to be here, and now, as far as the eye can see, I cannot see snow, you know. So then he identified something very specific problem with the glaciers, that the mother glaciers have disappeared. That means, again, this albedo or the smooth surface on the glacier that attracts, takes care of the new snowfall, just like a mother would take care and caress a baby. So if that has disappeared, then no matter how much it snows during the winter, twice or thrice more, there's not this caring surface on the glaciers for it to start multiplying. So now what's happening with glaciers is the melt will always be, you know, double, triple, 10 times, 20 times, but there is no chance of actually multiplying, you know. So can we even start about rejuvenating, regenerating glaciers, you know? It's very long way to go there. First, we need to address the problem so that we, without knowing, we shouldn't keep mindlessly exposing these places without specific policies and master plans. And that's where we would like to draw people's attention to. That's why we would like to sensitize people, first the locals, then regional, then national, and probably global. Because after all, it's just not a regional issue, not just a national issue, but a big global issue. In the whole debate about climate change on global platform, nobody is really focusing on the third pole. as opposed to the combination of Hindu Kush and the Himalayas and major rivers depend on the sources of the glaciers in the Hindu Kush and the Himalaya. And we are only talking about 2 billion people downstream, directly dependent on these glaciers. And on top of that, the whole food supply of the world. So we are in the battle, we are in the forefront where we are seeing all this brunt, direct effect of the glaciers. It's us now. In a matter of 10, 20 years, it's the world.
I would like we finish with the story of before you don't have West in Ladakh.
Yeah.
And you tell us the story of the jerrycan.
Oh, okay. So interesting. For me, Zanskar has been like a friend. How Zanskar is right now is how my life has been also, because I remember as a kid growing up on Zanskar, we hardly used to see anything mechanical, you know. The radio was the thing, you know. Every household might have a radio and they really take care of it, you know. And now, to a period where many people actually own cars and bikes, you know. So I've seen that whole period, and also remember as a kid how everything we use was very cyclical, you know. And something is produced from the earth, you consume it, you turn it into manure, it goes back to that. And even cloths, you know, even the fabric that we use for as traditional gowns, you use it until you end up with 100 patches on your gowns, but you still wear it. And after that, you'll make a mattress out of it. And after that, if it's torn more, then you use it as a saddle for donkeys and horses also. After that, you could use it as a rough cloth to pieces of, you know, again, patching together, you know. Every bits of pieces is gone out of that fabric. You still use it and keep using it. Another very prominent example I saw was the use of jerrycans. So jerrycans with this metal container used quite often by the military during wars, during the Kargil war, it was quite abundantly available, but you know, it was used by the army. Then people were, for them it was a very precious thing, because it solved a big problem for them, you know, carrying water from the river or nearest tap during winters and during summers also. So you would usually get it broken anyway, you know, with a few holes. So anyway, it's a cold temperature area, so you could use butter to seal these holes, but then you keep using for years to bring water until the hole is too big for you to patch butter onto it and then seal it, you know. Then it'll pass on as a drum. You could use it as a drum during parties or during gatherings. It's even used even now also. I remember this last winter I visited a few villages and they were still using it. It's a really nice sound they create out of it. And then you can put pebbles into this, you know, jerrycan, and then make it even more exciting, the sounds, you know. Then after that, if it's broken more, then you make, you know, you cut the edges and use it as a basket for dung, for wood, you know, or use it as a plate for cattle to drink water, to drink, to eat. And after that, children use it as skates during the winters, you know. And even the last bits of pieces that's left, it'll go to the local blacksmith in the village and he'll melt it and make a sickle out of it, or an axe, or any tool, or maybe like a scissor to cut, you know, cut wool, shear wool from sheep. So I saw time when these were not abundant scars, but they were treated very precious. Waste was precious. Nothing was waste. I've seen that period also. And not just jerrycan, just a tiny piece of plastic. I'm talking about 15 years ago, 20 years ago, not very long. I'm not that old also. So even that tiny Maggi packet would be passed on from this family with butter in it to another village maybe 30 kilometers away through somebody, and then that person will receive it. She'll take, or he'll take good care of it, and then make sure she uses it as next time to bring, send something back to somebody. And then it'll go through maybe 5-6 circles. This plastic will come back to you also, you know. That's just a tiny packet. And I remember people keeping very good care of it. They'll clean it, they'll put it under bed so that it's pressed well. But now it's just we didn't get this time to gradually adapt to change. Everything has been so sudden. There's a lot of gap between the traditional beliefs and the behaviors we had, mainly because of the philosophy of the Himalayan people, which is the belief in spirits and maintaining that fragile balance with different spirits of different elements and not exploit anything unnecessarily, is lost within this rapid change. And I dream about a time where I'm not an expert, but I just observe these things, and I just hope for a time when, you know, younger generation actually know these practices, these beliefs, and we can make it more relevant for today's time and make them feel proud about these beliefs. These are not superstitious beliefs. There were reasons to it. And the reasons were to keep this fragile balance alive in this very fragile ecosystem. The example I give, like if we didn't believe in spirits, then the little wildlife that we have would not survive. Even if I take 2-3 predators out of a little ecosystem habitat, they'll have drastic consequences on the vegetation of this whole range. So hunting was never core part of our culture. We wouldn't fish even if we had not enough food to eat during some, you know, famine or not times when you have not enough cultivation, mainly because there was no direct relationship we shared with these. With cattle, we had to bring them up to higher pasture during summer, bring them back, making sure there's enough fodder. So I'm taking care of that cattle. It is giving me back something. So the relationship was very direct. Although people might fish here and there, but it was never like a cultural thing, you know. So there were many reasons like this. And I'm always bewildered and surprised, amazed at the reasons behind these practices. It's just not superstition, that I can guarantee.
Yeah. Thank you. Do you want to add something?
We are living in a very exciting place, and the world has become much smaller than ever before. And more than anything now, we need collaboration. We need more bridges to bridge different communities, bringing back indigenous wisdom back to this community, and then learn something from modern technology and bring it back to indigenous communities, and just being open to, you know, share ideas and share technology. And it's possible more than ever, and I'm very hopeful. If you really want something, we will find the right set of people that come around and join us in our journey from here on. And it's been a lovely time in Oroville, and I'm quite sure I'm going to come back to this place more often, made a bond now. Thank you very much.
Thank you.